This episode of Dean Bakari's Meaningful Show is brought to you by Flashbooks, where you can get best-selling business and self-improvement book summaries that you can read or listen to in under 20 minutes. To learn more and get started for just a buck today, visit www.getflashnotes.com. Welcome to the Meaningful Show podcast, where every single week we work to bring you an inspiring insight, idea, or interview to help you live better, work better, and be better both in life and in business. Brought to you by MeaningfulHQ.com, we've got one very simple goal here on this show, and that is to help you do more of what matters and less of what doesn't. I'm your host, Dean Bakari, and if you're ready, then I'm ready. So let's get into it. Hey folks, it's Dean Bakari. Welcome back to the podcast. Today I am joined by author and storytelling machine, Paul Smith, who's the best-selling author of a series of books on the power of storytelling, including Lead with a Story and Parenting with a Story. And today he's here to talk with us about some of the big ideas behind his third book, Sell with a Story, which, as the title entails, is all about telling effective sales-related stories. So, Paul, welcome to the show. Thank you for being here.
Well, you're welcome. Thanks for having me, Dean. I think that might be the first time I was ever introduced as a storytelling machine. I think I like that. I'm going to have to add that to my business cards now.
Nice. I love it. I really enjoyed your first book, Lead with a Story, because you went into such detail. Like, you provided structure and step-by-step breakdowns on, you know, how to tell stories in the most effective way in the right context. So I just want to let you know, I appreciate how detailed you went with that book, because it's very helpful.
Well, thank you. And in fact, I tried to do even more of that in the in this third book here. I think probably if you think back to that first book, probably 2/3 of it was really just a collection of leadership stories from all these hundreds of CEOs and executives that I interviewed. And probably only 1/3 of the book is kind of the nuts and bolts of how you structure a story and use emotion and surprise and things like that. But for this third book, I tried to kind of do the opposite. I wanted 2/3 of the book to really be the nuts and the bolts of how, and only 1/3 of it being examples of the kind of stories that salespeople are telling in various parts of the sales process. So I tried to even go even a little bit deeper, if you can imagine. So if you were missing anything from that first one, you'll find it in this third one.
Very nice. Very nice. So how do you tell a compelling story, Paul?
So it probably starts with knowing what stories you need to tell, right? I mean, in fact, that's probably the number one reason that leaders or salespeople don't tell stories more often, is that they just don't know when they could or should tell stories, or they don't have a repertoire of stories to tell. So that's the first part of this book, is to introduce the reader to, there are 25 different sales stories that I think every salesperson needs to know how to tell. And I didn't expect there to be that many, by the way. I started out just interviewing salespeople at companies all over the world and trying to find out where they're telling stories. And what I found was that they're telling them all the way from as early as when they're meeting and introducing themselves to a new prospect, all the way through to building rapport with the buyer, to making the actual sales pitch itself, to handling objections, to negotiating price, and even closing the sale, and even after closing the sale, like follow-up after the sale and building loyalty.
Stories?
Yeah, like after they've already bought your product, like just maintaining good customer relationships, building loyalty, teaching other salespeople how your effective sales calls went. So there are a number of different reasons to tell stories even after the sales calls are done and the products are delivered. So in 25 different types of stories in all. So that's the first part of telling stories, is knowing where and when you should be telling stories and what kind of stories you should be telling. Because you can have all of the mechanics of storytelling down pat, and it won't matter if you're telling the wrong story or if you just don't have a good story to tell. So that's where you got to start.
Definitely. Yeah, you could have all the mechanics down, and if you're telling the wrong story to the wrong person, the wrong context, you're screwed, right?
Right. You know, you can imagine somebody that's got this wonderfully sexy voice and, that would make a Shakespearean actor proud, right? That can stand up and deliver a pitch-perfect speech with no stutters and stammers and great eye contact and all that kind of stuff. And if they're telling the wrong story, it just doesn't matter. Like, your audience will never forgive you for wasting their time with the wrong story. So in fact, I don't even focus in the book on a lot of that physical presence and delivery mechanisms. I've got one chapter on delivery that covers both oral and written delivery, but most of it is the development of the story. You know, what's the structure of the story, the context, the challenge, the conflict? How does the story resolve itself at the end? How do you get emotional elements into it and the element of surprise and the proper use of dialogue? You know, I try and avoid a lot of the stuff that you would have learned in a speech class, because storytelling is not about giving a perfect speech. You know, you can tell stories in any situation, in a hallway conversation with your boss, or a one-on-one conversation with a buyer, or in front of a large group of people. That's fine as well. But it should be a more conversational, casual thing. And in casual conversations, people stutter. People say things twice. People pause and think about what they're going to say next. And you know, if your storytelling comes across like it's some kind of highly produced Hollywood script, you're doing it wrong. Right? That's not what it's supposed to sound like.
Yeah, it's kind of like, I guess, you know, if you were having a conversation with Obama and he just went into full speech mode mid-conversation.
Oh my gosh, are you reading off a teleprompter in the middle of this conversation? You know, I mean, yes, it would just be awkward. And in fact, one of the interesting questions I asked a buyer, so in preparation for this book, I interviewed a bunch of salespeople, but I also interviewed a bunch of professional procurement managers, like people that buy for a living and meet with salespeople for a living. And one of the questions I asked them was, what is it that makes a sales pitch sound like a sales pitch?
What is it?
I got all kinds of interesting answers. You know, some of it was that it just sounded scripted and memorized. In fact, that was kind of the biggest part, was when the conversation shifted from something that sounded conversational to something that sounded memorized. And even the tone of voice changed a little bit. I mean, like you probably noticed yourself as you begin this podcast, your tone of voice sounds a little bit different. You sound like you're addressing a large audience, because I'm sure that you are, but you know that you're kind of giving an oratory to a large group, as opposed to having a conversation with your best friend over a beer, right? You know, and that change of tone and scriptedness is what makes them realize, I'm getting pitched something right now. And stories don't sound that way when you do them right. They just sound like a conversation that you're having.
It kind of reminds me, and please let me know if you've heard about this. I believe it was Winston Churchill who, when he would like prepare his speeches, he would intentionally add, you know, asides that made it look like it was coming right from the top of his head.
Well, that doesn't surprise me. I hadn't heard that about Winston Churchill, but I would think that would be very effective. Most of us don't have to do that. Like, most of us, when we're having a conversation, or even if we're given a speech, we're not so good that we have to put that stuff in there to fake it. I mean, I guess if you're a Hollywood actor and you're reading a script, you know, maybe they can write that into the script, but most of us just have to be trained not to make it too perfect, and just don't worry about it. In fact, a lot of my clients just breathe a sigh of relief when they're in my classes and they realize that, oh, you mean you're not going to videotape me and then critique every little and stutter and stammer? And I'm like, no, this is not that kind of a class. Like, that's not what I do. And they just get so comfortable after that. Good. This is just about telling stories. It's not about, you know, being on stage.
Right. I love that. So how would you advise someone if they came to you and said, Hey, Paul, you know, what are some of the key elements to telling a compelling story, a structure of a good story?
Yeah.
What would that be?
Yeah. So I guess if I had to pick like
the 25 that you have, from the 25 different storytelling sort of structures, I definitely want to talk about a few of the main ones. So, you know, what are some of the biggest ones that you would recommend people to definitely have in their repertoire?
Yeah. So, all right. So those are two different questions. So if you ask me which stories salespeople need to have, that's the list of 25, and I can give you two or three just to help you get a feel for that. But if you're asking, what is it about a story that makes it a great story? That's a very different question.
Okay.
So let's do both of them. So let's start with which stories, right? So it's things like when you've just met somebody new, it's tell them a story that helps them understand what it is that you do for a living. So this is the kind of story you would tell at, not at a cocktail party, but like at a conference. You're at a conference,
right?
You meet somebody, you're at the hors d'oeuvres table, you're both waiting on a drink. Oh, what do you do? Oh, what do you do? You know, and when people say, oh, well, I'm in charge of a logistics company that maximizes the efficiency of routing from core manufacturing experience to the desired consumer experience or something, you know, it's like, what does that even mean?
What did you just say?
Right. Yeah. But if instead they said, oh, well, you know, so what do you do? Oh, well, I'm in the chicken business. Okay. Well, so like, have you ever been to the grocery store and bought chicken? And by the time you got it home, it's just like this nasty, rancid smelling mess. And you're like, yeah, I hate it when that happens. We're like, yeah, my job is to make sure that doesn't happen. Right. And, you know, and then you can explain to them, you know, I meet with the people that make the chicken. I meet with the people that buy the chicken at the, you know, the grocery store people, and I meet with the distribution people, and I figure out a more efficient way to get that chicken from where it's grown on the chicken farm all the way to your kitchen without that happening, you know? So mm-hmm. It's just a short little story like that is so much more effective than this memorized management speak that we'd come up with. So
right.
that's like, that might be the first story that you tell somebody. But then if it turns out that this is somebody that you might want to do business with, you're probably going to want to tell them a little bit more involved story about what other clients you've helped and how you've helped them. Or when you're actually building rapport with them, you might want to tell them a story about a time that you made a mistake. You know, I call this very simply and not very creatively, but I'll tell you when I made a mistake story. You know, and that's because people want to do business with somebody they know is going to fess up to a mistake they've made.
Right.
That way they don't have to find out about it from somebody else.
Yeah.
Right. But you can't just tell them, look, if I ever make a mistake doing business with you, I'll tell you. Well, maybe you will, maybe you won't. I don't know. But if I told you a story about 3 years ago when I really screwed up with one of my clients and made a mistake, and I tell you the story about how I messed up and how I told them about it and how we fixed it all before it got to be too big of a problem, well, now I believe you that you would tell me
right.
because you've done it before. But just telling you that I would do that or telling you that I did do that is not very compelling.
Right.
Hearing the story about it is, you see? So you can go throughout the sales process and these kind of stories, you know, when you actually get into the sales pitch, then you're telling a story maybe about the kind of person that has this problem. So I call this a problem story. So if you're selling computer security solutions, you might tell a story about somebody who went to the bank to try to get money out and had their card rejected. So they went to a different machine and they got their card rejected again. And then they tried a different PIN number, thought maybe they'd forgotten. Well, they got rejected again. And then they get home and find out that the bank has been calling their wife, telling, you know, the wife, hey, your husband's in Las Vegas trying to get money out of a cash machine. Are you okay with that? You know, you can imagine the trouble that would create, right?
Right, yeah.
Now, our company fixes that, right? We have smarter solutions that don't involve calling your family members and embarrassing you in front of clients or frustrating you at the machine, you know. So it's just far better than giving them a list of benefits, you know. So that's a problem story. So
I like that.
We could go through a number of those others, but I'll just mention some of them so you can get an idea for it. A story to create a sense of urgency when you're trying to close the sale, you know. So instead of just, you know, if the person you're trying to sell something to says, "Oh, I love that, I want to buy it, but now's not the right time."
Yeah. How do you address that with a story?
Yeah. So a story that can explain to them, here's what happens when you wait. You know, I'll tell you, I've had customers before that have said, yes, I want that, I need that, I can afford it, but now's not the right time. I need to wait 6 months before whatever, whatever. And they waited. And 3 months later, something happened. They got acquired by a bigger company, and then their accounts receivable department had to take over all of the accounts for the new company. And they got so busy that they couldn't even buy the software solution that they'd agreed to buy from us. But gosh, now they wish that they had, because if they had, it would have been so much easier to bring on all that new business, because that's what our software does.
Mm.
You know, and so if you wait, things like that happen. And you're just putting yourself at risk. So, you know, as opposed to being told, no, you've got to have this right now. That's just not
compelling. Too polished, too rehearsed.
Right.
You told
right.
a great story. I think it was in the beginning of the book when you and your wife were at a museum or an art, and the pig painting. Can you tell that story for our audience? I like that.
Yeah,
one.
Sure. So that's a story to help you. To actually make your product more valuable or to add value to your product. So literally my wife and I were at an art show in Cincinnati, Ohio. My wife's an artist. She loves to paint and stuff. And so she got me to go to this art show with her. And so the truth is, I was just kind of carrying the bag, right? I mean, you know, I like looking at it, the stuff, but she's really knows what she's doing. So she's walking from booth to booth and just loving talking to the artist about their techniques and their inspiration and their mediums and all that kind of stuff. And she's looking for a picture for our kids' bathroom at home. So she's got this image in her mind of where it's going to go on the wall. And she gets to this one booth of this underwater photographer named Chris Goog. And he just does these mesmerizing pictures of sea anemones and coral reefs and stuff like that. And she's flipping through his pictures and she gets to this piece. She just gets emotionally attached to it. And I come over and look at it, and it looked about as out of place as a pig in the ocean, right? And you've read that and you know that because it was a picture of a pig in the ocean. And mm-hmm. I just thought, well, this is nuts. So eventually the guy comes over and I said, dude, what's with the pig in the ocean, right? And that, Dean, is when the magic started. He said, oh, yeah, it was the craziest thing. So he said that picture was taken off the beach of this uninhabited island in the Bahamas called Big Major K. And he said apparently a few years ago, this local entrepreneur decided he wanted to raise pigs for bacon. So he buys all these pigs. He throws them out on this island that nobody lives on, that he can put them out there for free. And he said, now look in the picture. Look behind the pig up there off the beach. Do you see the vegetation up there? And I looked and I said, well, yeah, but it mostly looks like cactus. And he said, yeah, that's a problem. Pigs don't like cactus. And he said, so they basically weren't eating. Well, the good news is not too long after that, a local restaurant owner on a neighboring island started boating his kitchen refuse every night over to Big Major K and dumping it just offshore. Well, pretty soon these little hungry pigs start smelling this food out and they brave the waters, right? And they learn to swim to get to this food that comes over every night about the same time. And he said, so when I went there to take pictures, he said, it was the easiest thing I ever did because I didn't even have to get out of the boat, right? These pigs have learned that approaching boats means food. And so when a boat comes up, they just swim right up to the boat. Like I just had to lean over and stick my camera in the water. Anyway, at that point, I already had my credit card out and I had it on the table. I'm like, right. We'll take it, right? Like, because now it wasn't just a silly picture of a pig in the ocean. It was a story. It was a story that I get to tell every time somebody comes to my house. And it's like this geography lesson and history lesson and animal psychology lesson all rolled into one.
Awesome,
right?
Conversation piece, definitely.
Yeah, exactly. So it literally made the picture more valuable by having a story attached to it than just being, you know, sold. Oh, there's a picture. It'll look great in your bathroom. Look, it's got the right color scheme. It's the right size. It's the right price, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. That reminds me of this. There was like a study conducted a few years ago about these, I think it was called the significant object study. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what it was called. Have you heard of it?
Yeah. In fact, I mentioned it in the book. Yeah. Go ahead and tell.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, it's just about how this group of people, they find just crappy little items on eBay.
Right.
And, you know, they buy them for pennies on the dollar. Make up a good story, a compelling one, emotionally charged, and sell it for, you know, exponentially more, and just repeat that process over and over and over again. And I don't remember all of the details, so you could please, you know, feel free to fill me in and fill our audience in. But that is really a powerful way to a powerful illustration of how important it is to attach a good story to everything you're trying to sell.
Yeah, you nailed it. That's it. They put this. They hired people to write these little 3 or 4 paragraph stories, and they put those in the description on eBay instead of what would have been there. Like, oh, this is a nutcracker. It was made in the 1950s. It's 17 inches tall. It weighs this. You know, whatever. They took out the description and they just put a story with no description, and people paid 10, 15, 20 times as much for it with the story than they would have if it was just, here's this item and a description. Because now it's got a story attached to it.
Yeah. And by the way, folks, so the significant object study, a lot of those objects were, they were fake stories. And you don't have to tell a fake story, I believe, in order for you to increase the value of whatever it is you're trying to sell. I think everybody's got tons of awesome stories they can tell that can add more value to whatever it is that we're trying to sell. I think that's a big like problem with a lot of people. They think for some reason that they need to make stuff up in order to increase something's value with the story. Can you kind of talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. Yeah. So first of all, I think you're right. You obviously don't have to. In fact, I encourage people not to do that. In that particular study, all the stories were made up, but they said that at the beginning. These are made up stories. Yeah. They made it pretty clear that these are fictional stories. And what I tell people is, 95% of the stories you tell ought to be true stories, things that actually happened to you or happened to somebody else or something you heard about or something that happened to the person down the hallway at work or whatever. Those are the kind of stories that you should be trafficking in at work. But if you don't have the right story for the right situation, you find yourself in a situation where you don't have the story, I tell people it's okay to make up a story, but only under one condition. And that's the same condition that they used in the study. And that is that you tell people you made it up, right? Because if you don't, now you're just a liar, right? And you're going to get caught eventually.
Right.
But I have been in situations, and I've got two or three examples out of, 100 in the book of a made up story. And I say right up front, okay, look, this is totally made up, but I just didn't have the right story. But just go with me on this because I think it will help you understand what I'm trying to communicate. Right. And by the way, after they hear the story, they're like, oh, yeah, but that's the kind of thing that probably happens all the time. Yeah. Well, of course it does. I just don't know a specific person, place, and time to tell you about a true story. So I've told you a plausible story, but I told you, look, I'm totally making this up. So you can, but you shouldn't have to 95% of the time. You should be mining your own history and those of the people around you and your clients and customers and your suppliers for stories so that you have a repertoire in your head to use at a moment's notice.
What's your advice, Paul, on shortening stories, for instance, like if you've only got a compressed period of time and what's your advice on eliminating details that would otherwise be important to include?
Yeah. Great question. First of all, stories like this, sales stories are 2 minutes long. Okay. They're not 10, they're not 15, they're not 20, they're not seven, right? Sales stories on average. There are 40 or 50 sales stories I documented in the book. They average 2 minutes. They range from about 30 seconds to about 4 or 5 minutes at most. Now, my first book, Lead with a Story, those were leadership stories usually told by executives to people in their organizations. Those are a little bit longer. Those averaged 5 minutes or 4 minutes and ranged from 3 to 5 minutes long. They're still pretty short. These are not 15-minute stories. And a lot of people, when they just start into storytelling, their stories are way too long because they, like you said, they have so much detail that they really didn't need. So the way to keep that out, well, first of all, is to know if it's a leadership story, it ought to be 4 minutes. And if it's a sales story, it ought to be 2 minutes. Mm-hmm. The second thing is, I have in the book little templates where you fill out you answer the questions and it will basically put your story in the right structure. So like answering the question, where and when did it happen? Who's the hero? What did they want? What was the problem they ran into? What did they do about it? How did it turn out in the end? And what did you learn from it? Right. If you answer those questions, you'll essentially have told the story in the proper order. And if you've got a story that's too long, what you do is you put it all of that information into this template, and anywhere you've got information that doesn't really answer one of those questions, it's not necessary. That's what you can get rid of. Nice. And if you get rid of things and you find I've gotten rid of so much that one of these questions is not answered, now you've cut too much. So it helps you get exactly the right length of a story.
Very nice. Very nice. What would you say that most people, of all the people that you've worked with, from companies to individuals, what do you think most people get wrong when they're trying to tell a powerful story?
Yeah. So there are so many things like being too long, or not being relevant, or not being true. Some people do that, and like I said, now you know how to deal with that. But the most common mistake I see is that people will apologize or ask permission to tell a story. Mm. And you've seen that happen, right? You're sitting in a meeting, you got 5 or 10 people sitting around a table. Somebody raises their hand and says, I'm sorry, I didn't really mean to interrupt, but can I just tell a quick story? I promise it'll just take a minute, right? Now, what does that communicate to the rest of the people sitting there about how valuable they think the story is?
This is about to be really annoying.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, why would you want to do that to yourself, right? I mean, leaders don't ask permission to lead. They just lead, right? Never apologize or ask permission to tell a story. Just tell it. In fact, I tell people, go one step further. While you're not apologizing or asking permission, don't even tell people you're going to tell a story. Because that's one of the other things I see people do wrong so often is
they'll say— Yeah, I was actually going to ask you about that.
Yeah. They'll say, hey, let me tell you a story. Okay. I mean, So let me just ask you how you would feel about this. So let's say it's Monday morning, you're at work, the meeting's about to start, the boss comes in and she says, all right, well, I thought I'd get this meeting kicked off by telling you a story. Okay, now you honestly tell me, what is going through your mind at that moment?
For me, it's usually, this is going to be cheesy. Isn't going to be anything. It's not going to be anything exciting or compelling. I'm not about to get inspired. You know, whereas when someone just starts talking to me and just naturally just transitions into an mm-hmm. awesome story, and I don't even realize that they're doing it until they get to the point, that's when I'm like, whoa, that was
right.
That was right. Really, really awesome. Like, you know, that was really inspiring. How did you do that?
Well, so imagine instead if your boss said this, well, let's go ahead and get the meeting kicked off. Now, something really important happened last week, and it's totally changed the way I think about running this department. And I thought I'd tell you about that.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, are you interested in hearing what she's got to say?
Absolutely.
Of course you are. Now, in both cases, she's going to tell you exactly the same story. But in one case, you're like, your eyes are rolling in the back of your head already. You don't want to hear it. But in the other case, you can't wait to hear it. And that difference is what I call the hook, right? So it's that first sentence or half a sentence you say before you actually start telling the story. And so it's never wrong to just start telling the story. In fact, that's the best thing you can do is just start telling the story. But most people need a little bit of a transition to get them into the story. And what they normally do is, like I said, apologize or ask permission or tell people, I'm going to tell you a story or can I tell you a story? And that's the wrong way to set up a hook, or the wrong way to transition in. If you need a transition in, it should be a simple few words or, you know, half a sentence that just communicates to the audience that what you're about to hear is important to you, not to me, but to you. And so that sentence that I just used of, you know, something really important happened last week and it's changed how I think about running this department. I thought you'd like to hear about that.
Yeah.
Right. And then I'm telling the story. So that's that hook is what you need. That gets it, and it answers the question, by the way, why should I listen to this story? Yeah. That's the first question in the series of 8 or 9 questions that I lay out that your story needs to answer in order. And that first one is so important because if you don't answer it, they might not listen to your story, right?
Yeah. So let me tell you where I get stuck sometimes. If whether it's a speech or just a podcast episode, where it's a solo, not an interview, where I'm trying to convey, you know, trying to get a specific message across. Sometimes I'll say, hey, today we're going to talk about X, Y, Z. Mm-hmm. And then I'll just dive right into the story. Sometimes I'll do that. Sometimes I'll just dive right into the story and the listeners won't know exactly what this episode is going to be about until I get to the sort of the hook, right? Mm-hmm. Where we get to the precipice of the story and we say, okay, well, that's why it's so important not to judge people. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Get to the point of it. So would you say it's better to just start off in story mode every time?
No, not if it's completely blind to your audience. Like,
right. Because other than the title of the episode, the listeners wouldn't know what the story would be about.
Right. Well, if your title is good enough or clear enough, then I think you can. I mean, like if the title of the podcast is, you know, how I learned to not get fired or whatever. Okay. I'm expecting now to hear a story about probably a time you did get fired and the lesson you learned from it so that you don't get fired again the next time. Right.
Yeah.
And so if that was the title and you started off, so my first job out of college, blah, 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 blah. Like I'm totally into it because I know what's going to happen in the story is that somebody's going to get fired and I'm going to learn a lesson from it that I want to learn. But if the title is not that clear about what it is and you just start off with a story, you might lose your audience because they don't know. They might not even listen to it.
Yeah.
And most stories are not delivered in a podcast blind like that. Most stories are delivered in a conversation. And so it's very clear why you're telling that story. Like if you might ask me, hey, Paul, have you ever gotten fired before? And I go, yeah, twice, in fact. Yeah, the first time was, and now I'm telling you a story.
Right.
But you want to hear it because you've asked me about getting fired, and now I'm telling you the first
context
time.
And everything has already been set. It's
exactly. But like you've said, in a solo podcast with no question being asked at the beginning and no context of the of a conversation, I think you need this thing that I call a hook. And your title could do it for you if it's clear enough. But sometimes those titles are a little bit cryptic. So that's why I think you need the thing like the boss saying, hey, something really important happened last week. It's changed how I think about running this department. Let me tell you about that. Okay, now you're going to tell me a story, but now I want to hear the story. But notice that what the hook doesn't do, it doesn't give away the ending of the story, and it doesn't give away the exact lesson, right? So if you did that, it would be like if you found out at the beginning of Star Wars that Darth Vader was Luke Skywalker's dad, or that Princess Leia was his sister. I mean, it would screw up the whole story if you found out that at the beginning. So don't give away too much, but just give away enough for them to know, this is going to be interesting to me. I'm interested in hearing the story or learning the lesson that you've promised to teach me. You just haven't told me exactly what it is.
Nice.
Does that make sense?
It does. It does.
So look at the chapter on the hook. There's a whole chapter just on the hook, which will give you some ideas for how to do that.
Awesome. Awesome. Let's talk a little bit about call to actions, if we could.
Okay.
What are some suggestions that you have for, okay, so you've told a really compelling story, you know, everything is in place, you're feeling good about it, and now you're at a point where you're going to have to ask someone to take action or a group of people to take action. What are some good ideas on how to do that?
Yeah. So first of all, if you've told a great story that's highly relevant and compelling, you won't have to.
They're ready to take action.
Exactly. They will know, you know, exactly what they need to do. Like the Pig Island story.
Yeah.
He didn't end that story with, so don't you want to buy my picture of the pig, right?
Right.
I just said, give me the pig. Right? You take my money, please.
Yep.
Right? So that's the main purpose of telling a story, is that you won't have to. In fact, the three most powerful things you can do after you tell your story, the first one is just listen, right? Mm. Just let the story do its work and see if your audience learns the lesson you wanted them to learn and is ready to take the action you wanted them to take. Because if they are, it's far better for them to come to that conclusion themselves than for you to tell them what the lesson is or what the recommended action is. So give them a little space to tell you, oh, after hearing your story, oh my gosh, yeah.
These are the connections that I made.
Yeah, I learned this. I'm never going to do that. And therefore, I probably won't get fired like you did first job or whatever.
Right.
So so let them come to the conclusion themselves. But if they don't, if they don't respond, or if they tell you a lesson that you didn't want them to learn, then it's time for you to do those two things. Tell them the lesson that you hoped they learned. And usually you can do it by saying, well, here's what I learned from that, as opposed to here's what you should learn. That sounds like you're bossing them around.
Yeah.
Let me just tell you what I learned from this story when it first happened or when I first heard the story. And that'll kind of lead them in the right direction. And then the last one then is the recommended action. So here's what I think you should do about that. But again, give them the chance to articulate that first themselves, because that's the whole power of a story, is it leads them there without being told, go there.
Right. Yeah, I think I remember reading in a Dale Carnegie book a while back that one of the best ways to get someone to take action is to sort of lead them to the point where they're finishing your sentences and thoughts for you in their own minds.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. So if you were to, one thing I always like to ask authors about their books is, you know, if you were to just pick one major idea and that you would have to leave somebody with and say, hey, look, shake you. I'm shaking you right now. This is the one thing that I want you to, if you don't pick anything else up from this book, if you leave with just one idea, this is it. What would that be?
Yeah, it'd be get rid of all the tools that you typically use when, in this case, conducting a sales call, and see how you could do it if you didn't have them. What if you didn't have your sales pitch outline and your PowerPoint presentations and your slick brochures and what are all the other tools that you take into a situation like that, and ask yourself, what would you do instead? And I think what you'll come up with is three or four stories that you would tell Because you can remember stories easily. It's hard to remember a sales pitch unless it's on the slides, on the slide deck, right?
Right.
And try that. And I think you'll have a lot more success.
I think that's great advice. I love that. Are there any books that you found particularly helpful as you were sort of learning more about storytelling?
Yeah, there are a lot. In fact, I've probably read 50 or 60 books on storytelling just as part of the preparation for writing my own books. And of course, what I tried to write was what was left unsaid or what I thought wasn't done very well. So, it would be hypocritical of me to not tell you that I think mine's the best, because that's why I wrote it, because I think it needed to be written.
Yeah, no, I think that a lot of books on public speaking and storytelling that have been written in the past, even some of the best ones, don't focus enough on the nuts and bolts, as you were mentioning earlier,
right?
Which I think is, I think you did a great service to this whole, speaking world, where people are trying to learn how to become better speakers, more effective speakers, because there's a lot of stuff about presence and, like stage sort of presence, and speaking style than there is about actually getting down to business.
Right.
So I think
I avoid that like the plague. of course, I'd love everybody to run out and buy Sell the Story. But I will tell you the book that got me kind of started in this direction was a book that came out, I think, in 2007 by Chip and Dan Heath. And it's Made to Stick.
Yeah.
And one of their six criteria that they say that make ideas sticky was that it was a story. And that was kind of my first bite of this apple that made me want to go deep into the art and the science of storytelling, and has kind of led me on this whole path ever since.
Love it.
It's a fabulous book.
Yeah, when the story clinics that you mentioned, when I came across those in the book, I was like, that reminded me of Made to Stick, because they included their clinics in there as well.
Exactly. Yes. So that was not an accident at all. Yeah, I loved that idea. In fact, they called them something clinics. I called mine story clinics because they're stories. I can't remember exactly what they called them, but the word clinic was in there, and I thought that was savvy, so I borrowed that.
Yeah. Good stuff. Well, honestly, Paul, I could talk about storytelling and speaking for hours on end, but we don't have that time.
Right.
So I'm just going to go ahead and dive right into the closing question.
All right.
Which, that's the same question that I ask every single one of our guests here on the show.
All right.
And that question is this: what does it mean to you specifically, Paul, to live a meaningful life?
Does that mean how am I living meaningfully, or?
Yeah. What is it that makes what you do, the life that you lead, meaningful for you specifically? Oh, how are you doing that?
Yeah. It. And this may sound corny as well, but it's making the world a better place. I mean, I used to have a job, pretty typical corporate executive role at the Procter & Gamble company. I worked there for 20 years, and I left all that to write these books and to do the speaking and training that I do. And I have as my mission is to make the world a better place, one story at a time. And so that's what I do now. And I that's one of the most rewarding things for an author, is to get, emails and phone calls from people all over the world that I've never met, that have, read one of my books, and to tell me what a difference it made in their life or their work or their career or whatever. And that's what I'm about now. And it's incredibly rewarding. I don't get a dime for that phone call or that email, but it goes into my emotional bank account.
Absolutely.
Of I'm feeling better about my contribution to the world. And so the business books I write are supposed to help people be better leaders or better salespeople, be more successful that way. And my second book was for parents, to help them teach their kids character and life lessons through story. And that's some of the most important work that human beings do, is raising their kids. And that's my contribution to the world and to make it a better place. And to me, that's a lot more meaningful than what it was that I was doing from 9 to 5 in a big office building.
Yep. You can say that again. Good stuff, Paul. Folks, the name of the book is Sell with a Story: How to Capture Attention, Build Trust, and Close the Sale by Paul Smith. I believe it comes out on September 8th. Is that right?
Yes. I think it's already snuck out early on Amazon. But that's the official launch date. But you can get it now.
Good stuff. And real quick before we go, if you could, please tell our listeners, Paul, where they could get in touch with you and learn more and connect if they wanted to do so.
Yes, thank you. So it's www.leadwithastory.com. So just the name of my first book, .com.
Very good. Very good. And folks, I'll have all of the resources and things of that nature that we discussed in this episode available for you over at meaningfulhq.com or at getflashnotes.com in the show notes. So thank you so much for stopping by, Paul. I appreciate it. Our listeners certainly appreciate it. And until next time, folks, go out there every single day and live like you give a damn. It's Dean. Listen, I hope you enjoyed this episode of the podcast. If you found this episode inspiring, or if anything else you've heard on the show has helped you or made an impact on your life in any way, I'd really appreciate it if you showed me a little love with a quick review over on iTunes or on whichever podcast platform you tune into the show on. Every single review helps us reach and inspire more people to live like they give a damn. Listen, if you've got self-help questions of your own that you'd like me to answer live on the podcast, hit me up over at meaningfulhq.com. You can submit them over on the contact page, or you can just shoot your questions directly to me at questions@deanbakari.com. Thanks again so much for subscribing, sharing, and tuning into the show. I've said it before, I'll say it again. It's because of you and tens of thousands of other listeners from around the world tuning in every single week, week after week, day after day, that we are able to continue creating content to help you crush it and make an impact in your life and at work. So thank you for being part of this and continuing to share the podcast with your friends, your family, and anyone else you think it could help. Until next time, this is Dean Bakari telling you to go out there every single day and live like you give a damn.